I'd like to introduce our first speaker for the night, and please help me welcome Frank.
I am Frank. I am an alcoholic. You know, it's kind of terrifying to get up here in front of a bunch of youngsters like you. Believe me. I mean it. How terrifying. No, but really, when I came on the program, I could count, I believe, on my hands those alcoholics here in the valley that were under 25 to 30 years old. When you went to a meeting, in all probability, they were from 45 to 95. I'm in between that, by the way. Quite a ways in between it. So when I look out on you youngsters here, it's actually hard for me to comprehend the fact that there are so many young people coming onto the program and using the program to better themselves, to better their lives, to better everything concerned. It's wonderful. I, up till several years ago, wasn't quite sure if this was a inspired program or not, but now I'm positive that it is. I'm absolutely positive. There's no doubt in my mind. This young man here, I envy him. In a way, I was sitting there when all the young, pretty girls came up that were just starting in and threw their arms around him. You know, that's quite a job here. In this particular meeting, and it should go high. I know where I younger it'd go high as hell, believe me. I'm 70 years old, but my ideas aren't 70 years old, believe me. That is the greatest thing that I know of in AA. The laughter. The laughter of AA. You know, when you stop and think of the days and the weeks and the months and the years that some of us spent, and there was no laughter in it at all. There was no laughter. It was a lost commodity in our lives. And all of a sudden, we find a group of people that are very similar to us. As a matter of fact, they're damn near exactly like us. And we can identify with them, talk with them, put our hands on them, feel them, put our arms around them, and feel at home and feel comfortable and laugh. My God, that's one of the greatest pleasures in AA. Some years ago, I was in Stockton at the conference. It was my pleasure, believe me, to be the master of ceremonies of the conference, that particular one. And I mentioned the laughter in AA from the podium. And when the meeting was over, I came down, and I think I had at least 40 or 50 people come up to me and say, Frank, that was one of the best things of the whole night. It made us think, the laughter in AA. And I've thought on it time and time and time again. You know, we can be very upset in our personal lives. We can be very upset in our financial lives, in our moral lives, and God knows what. But for some reason, when we come to an AA meeting and come through that door, there's something here that I don't understand. I really don't quite grasp it. That happens. To me, at least. I don't know about you. I'm judging you by myself now. Something happens that changes the chemistry of my thinking. It changes it. And all those things that are bothering me so desperately, those things that are just worrying the hell out of me, they seem to slide off for a little while. And for an hour or an hour and a half, I'm free of them. I think that is just absolutely wonderful. I think that's another one of the side benefits of Alcoholics Anonymous. And when I leave here, I feel much better than I did when I came in. You see, I can put my arms around you if I want to, and you don't pull back from me. I can tell you whatever happens to come to my mind if I wish, and you'll listen as a rule. Or you may tell me something. Now, it's the same way with 12-step work. When you go out on 12-step work, you go out to help someone, which is our purpose, our whole purpose for being in this organization, whether you're aware of it or not, to keep yourself sober and to help some other suffering alcoholic. That's the one whole purpose we're here for. It might not do that individual a hell of a lot of good. It might not help him a damn bit. You go out and you try to tell him about the program, and he pukes all over your shoes and in your car, and you do your damnedest. There's times you hate the son of a bitch, but you'll save him or kill him one. And you try. Now, it may not do you too much good. I mean, might not do him too much good. But after you clean up, after you've got him to a meeting, whether he takes or not, and you go home after it's over and you think about it, damn, it's a wonderful feeling to yourself, not to him. But who knows? You may have helped him. He may come back the second time. If he does, you're a winner. See, your job, all your job is in 12-step work, is to carry the message. You're not to convert him. You're not to make a Baptist out of him or a Catholic or Seventh-day Adventist or even an AA member. You are to carry the message to that gentleman or that lady. And believe me, there's some of us sitting here right now that would never have ever believed they'd been called ladies or gentlemen at a later date. I happen to be one of them. I was confined in Agnew's as a dipsomaniac. That, in those days, was a drunk or an alcoholic or whatever the hell you want to use. Just a damn wino. You want to know the truth about it. And it was my pleasure, and I say pleasure because I mean it, to stay out there for 92 days. Now, I could have been out at 30, but I was scared to death. I had found a degree of dryness, not sobriety, but a degree of dryness that I loved. I did not have to wait in the morning for the damn liquor store to open to go get my booze. I didn't have to chisel. I didn't have to steal. I didn't have to do anything of these things to get my bottle of wine. I was living without wine for the first time in years. In over 30 years, the first time in my life, I was living without any kind of alcoholic drink. And I liked it. I actually liked it. You see, the cobwebs were starting to get out of my brain, as it were, and I started to think for myself, instead of letting emotions run me, I was letting my brains run me for a change. That was in 30 days. And in 60 days, it was twofold and then some. I felt so much better. My stomach didn't hurt anymore. I just felt real good, and I was scared to death of booze. And I might add, I still am today. In 90 days, I did not want to leave that place. I did not want to go out into the world where booze was available at my request. Now, I could have had booze in Agnew's. Don't get me wrong. You can get anything out there that you wish, just like you can in San Quentin. It doesn't matter. You can get whatever you want, whatever you're capable of paying for. However, I didn't want that. I wanted to stay absolutely clean. And I devoted all my energies and all my thoughts toward that staying clean. And day after tomorrow will be 16 years. So it's been quite a while. I'm proud of that. I'm going to tell you truthfully. I understand you're not supposed to be proud of this and that and the other thing. But for a man that drank for all those many years to have not even had one beer in that length of time, yes, I'm proud of it. And if the good Lord is willing, and I'm sure He is, and if I've got enough brains to stay with AA, which I am not quite sure, I shall remain dry to the end of my days. Now, how long that's going to be, God only knows. I don't. I hope to, anyway. So you youngsters, when you come along and you see old turkeys like me up here that went through we went through hell, believe me. We did not have halfway houses. We did not have government help. We had nothing except the insane asylum. That's what we had. We either went there or we were put there by court order, or that was it. But a bunch of Alcoholic Anonymous members got together and they started a place called the Downtown Fellowship. Now, the Downtown Fellowship was strictly a bum refuge. It was for guys with bimbles on their back. It was guys who had no homes, had nothing, were absolutely destitute, going through on trains, God knows where they come from. But it was a large room when I got there, and it had a bunch of overstuffed chairs that people had donated. They had a coffee bar, and they used donated coffee, and the bakeries would bring donuts occasionally, day old or 2 days old or 3 days old. It didn't matter too much because you could always dunk them in the coffee. That softened them up. And you see, all these things, that was all that was there. But they did have meetings. They did have meetings every night. And they had meetings every noon. And that was my refuge. I was told when I left Agnew's by members of Alcoholics Anonymous, don't even stop to go home, go to a meeting. And I did that. And for those last 16 years, almost, that has been my biggest idea as far as AA is concerned. Go to a meeting, get busy, get into service, be active. The more active you are, the easier it's going to be for you. And anyone that tells me that they can't do 12-step work, they, in my idea, are defying God, I'll tell you truthfully, because you were put here, as far as I'm concerned, one reason and one reason only, and that's to help your fellow man. And you are qualified, if you're a drunk, if you're an alcoholic, you are vastly qualified to help another alcoholic, whether you are aware of it or not. I want that understood. Don't ever tell me that I can't do it, because there is your self-honesty shot to hell. Because you can do it. There's not a person sitting in this room that can't do it. I repeat, your job is to carry the message. It's not to convert them. Carry the message. Tell them what you have. But you can't carry anything if you haven't got it yourself. So the way to get that is your 12 steps. You work the 12 steps, and I promise you, as the book promises you, as everyone concerned with any length of time on AA, they'll promise you, you'll be vastly qualified to do this. Now, the first, second, or third times, I would suggest taking someone with you that has more time on the program. I think it's best, because some of these clowns can throw questions at you that it takes a smart cookie to answer, believe me. I'm not claiming to be a smart cookie, because I've been blasted several times. I remember one case, I went out to a trailer. I made a big mistake to start with. The wife called me. They called in and said, told somebody down at central office, oh, my husband's having a horrible time. Will you come and help him? And this person inadvertently called me and told me that this gentleman had called and wanted help. And I accepted the call, and I went. I walked in, knocked at the door, walked into this trailer, and there was two ladies, very attractive women in their 40s, 45. I repeat, anything under 50 is very attractive, you know. And here was this little fellow sitting on the Chesterfield, I guess he stood maybe 5 feet 2 inches tall, weighed maybe 125 pounds, and he says, who the hell are you? And I said, well, I'm Frank from AA. And he says, I knew you were, you big son of a bitch. I knew who you were when you walked in the door with that book under your arm. Who called you? And I said, well, this is so-and-so, isn't it? He says, you're damn right, it's so-and-so. But what are you doing here? And I said, well, I was called here. He said, young man, he said, I know more about that book than you ever will know. He says, I know more about Alcoholics Anonymous than you ever will know. And he says, I'm going to sit here and drink as long as I damn please, and you aren't going to do anything about it. You're not going to tell me anything about it. You're not even going to stay here. You're getting your butt out of here right now. Well, that's a hell of a reception for a young AA member that's trying to convert some guy. It's discouraging. He hurt my feelings. He hurt my feelings. And I felt sorry for him. And I went to say something. He says, shut up and get out. And I said, all right. He says, how do you like it? And I said, not particularly. I said, there's only one thing. And he said, what? I said, I'm sober and you're not. And that was it. I left with that flash, boy. That I cut him, boy. I stuck it in, turned it over. See? That really did my heart good. Well, when I got home, I called Central Office, and I said, who the hell was the dummy that sent me on that? And later on, she became a very dear friend of mine, and she says, it was me. And I said, don't ever call me if a wife calls me or a husband calls me. Call me if the guy calls me, but don't do that. And she said she wouldn't, never again. And that took care of that. I never saw him again. Now, he probably died drunk. I don't know. Or then he could have died in an automobile accident. I don't know. But I did what I was called on to do. I carried the message whether he liked it or not. So again, I repeat, kids, all you have to do is carry the message. And you can do it. And if you're real smart and want to stay sober and clean up your act, do it. Because it's fun. At the time, you might not think so, but it's fun. You know, I've got quite a few babies here. I just had one die. He's a guy, I'll tell you about him and then I'll sit down. This guy's name was Jim, Jim T. He was a fairly wealthy man. He lived on a ranch up off of San Felipe Road. He was married to a lovely lady. She was quite a drinker, too. But Central Office called me one day here 2 years ago, and they said, Frank, we've got one that wants help. This was about 10 o'clock at night. And I said, okay, where is it? And he told me where it was. And I have a VW bus that I drive when I go after an alcoholic, because I learned a long time ago, it's got a linoleum floor in it. If anything happens, it's easy to clean up. And I take that deliberately for that reason. I'm not kidding. I really do. So I went out San Felipe Road, and it was darker than the hinges of hell, and I looked high and I looked low. I looked at boxes and I looked at, went up and knocked on doors and I did everything. I could not find this place. So I went back home and I called the guy and I said, look, I called his wife, I should say. Could I come tomorrow morning? And she said, why, yes. I said, I cannot find the place. She says, well, it is very difficult to find. So the following morning, I grabbed my wife. Now, as long as I've been doing 12-step work, I like somebody else with me, because what I can't answer, someone else may be able to. So anyway, we went out, and my God, it was 3/4 of a mile up an old dirt road that winds all the way around off of San Felipe Road. It was really hard to find in the daytime. But I found it, and I picked this gentleman up, and I took him down to the detox. He was in pretty bad shape. He stayed down at the detox until he was sober. I went in and see him while he was there several times. And he called me and asked me if I'd take him home. And I said, yes. I went and got him, took him home. And he became very interested in the program, and he swallowed it hook, line, and sinker. He really went for it. And he was gung-ho to get out on 12-step work, because I am. But Christ, a man that's been on the program a week isn't very well qualified to go out 12-step work. But he studied and he did everything, and we went to Rincon over here. And he became, after 6 months, he became secretary. And he just loved it. And he called me one day and he says, they call me for a 12-step call. Will you go with me? And I said, yes. And we went. And we got this guy. And this guy is still in the program. He happens to be another baby of mine. But Jim used to come over at the house all the time, and we'd kick AA around. We went to meetings. We just had a ball. I grew to love the man very, very, very much. He became probably as close to me as any man I know. And he went down to Mexico on a vacation, down to Mazatlan. And my wife and I, we go to Mexico quite often. As a matter of fact, we've just returned. And while down there, he wanted an AA meeting, but he couldn't find one. So he went around in the motels looking for easy does it signs on cars. And he rounded up 12 guys, believe it or not. And by God, he had an AA meeting there in Mazatlan. Now, this man met a gentleman from Oregon while he was there, and he had what they called a stump ranch up in Oregon. And that is a ranch way out. God, it's in the boonies, believe me. If you ever get out there, you'll never get away until the guy that runs the place wants to let you, because there's no way to get out or in. It's beautiful. It's out in the woods, and they raise all their own food. They raise everything. Anyway, he decided he would take a load of clothes and food and whatnot up to the stump ranch. When Jim got back, he'd told him they were short of stuff. So he loaded up an El Camino truck he had. He went down to Salvation Army and bought a whole bunch of blankets from them. And he bought clothes and God knows what he got. And away he went to the stump ranch. Well, when he got up there, he was extremely impressed. So when he come back, he called me the day he got back, and he says, I want to talk to you. And I said, what is it? He says, well, come on out that ranch. Can you do it? I want to talk to you. And I said, okay. So I went out, and he told me, he says, I happen to be a friend of Hewlett and Packard. And he says, he owns about 10,000 acres down here away. And he said, I'm going to talk to him and see if he can't donate about 20 or 30 acres or 40. And I'm going to start something of the same thing down here. Now, this man had been on the program for a year and a half. So that was his plan. But he called me about a week later, and he said, Frank, I'm feeling awful. He says, I feel horrible. He says, I've got to go to the hospital. Will you take me? I said, of course I'll take you. So I took him and took him into O'Connor's Hospital. Now, he had been under the care of two doctors in Los Gatos for over a period of 3 years, and they told him that he had had a little pancreatic trouble, and that was it. Well, he wasn't satisfied with that, and he asked me, he said, who is your doctor? And I told him, he says, why is he your doctor? I said, because he understands alcoholics. And he said, do you think he would take me? And I said, I don't know, call him and ask him. So he called him, and he said, yes, he'd see him. So he took one look at him, and that's when he went to the hospital. I got a little ahead of my story. And they diagnosed it as a severe cancer in the abdominal area here that was inoperable. It covered his pancreas, his stomach, part of his lower colon. Oh, it was a mess. So they told him he had 6 months to live. So my wife and I were gone, and we come back, and I went up to see him, and he said, you know, I'm worried about that stump ranch. I said, what do you mean you're worried about stump ranch? He says, those people need things up there, and they haven't got them. Damn it all, he said, I was going to go up there. Now I won't be able to. I said, I told you, tell you what I'll do, Jim. I'll go for you. And he says, you're kidding. I said, no, I'll go for you. We put the word out, the different meetings, that we needed clothes, that we needed blankets, that we needed this and that and the other thing. And friends, you won't believe it. You won't believe it. You never saw so damn many clothes, one thing and the other, in your life. Instead of me going up there by myself, well, there was three of us going up there. There was three of us. Went up hauling this stuff up to the stump ranch, and you never saw anybody so happy in your life as when they got it. Now, When we come back, I went up and I told Jim about it. Now, it's a strange thing. Why am I telling you this? Well, I'm going to tell you why. Here's a guy I called on in a 12-step call that went to Mexico, that met a guy from Oregon, that told a guy from California that they were having trouble in Oregon, and the guy from California organized and went to Oregon and fixed them and come back here and then went to Mexico. All on one 12-step call. Have you any idea how many people were involved in that? It's amazing. It's amazing. One 12-step call that my wife and I made on this one man. Now do you see why I think it's a divinely inspired program? Now do you see why I say it's our job for one alcoholic to help another alcoholic? Now do you see why I'm so damn proud to be an alcoholic? Kind of makes you think, doesn't it? Thank you.
Speaker for the night, I'm going to say this right once. Will everybody please help me in, no, that ain't, how do you say this? No, Jim, that ain't it. This is D. Thank you.
I'm Dorothy and an alcoholic. Is there any other alcoholics here besides me? Yeah. Jeez, I don't even see anybody that's not quite sure. It always tickles me when I hear somebody saying, I don't know, I don't think I'm really an alcoholic. I wonder what the hell they went to their first meeting for. Because they thought they were suffering of hangnails. I didn't say what I usually say, Jim. I came to the program at age 45, and I was too young to give up all that fun I was having. And you whippersnappers think you can give it up already. Well, you know something? I didn't have a problem before I was between 35 and 45, and then it began. Those hangovers got longer, they hurt worse, and I was an unfortunate drunk, but I must have been a damn bullheaded one to go through what I did. I could not drink the next morning. I tried one time when we were going to go from San Diego up to see the Rose Bowl game, and I put a half a bottle up through my mouth and up my nose, and I finally said, "The hell with it, I'll suffer." It would not go down. Now, I suffered for years of a glandular disability that might have had something to do with this. But I would drink, and as long as I stayed on my feet, dancing and traveling, I was fine. But if you let me sit down, or I could sneak off and get a bath mat and put it in the bathtub and crawl in, I'd go to sleep. And there's no waking me up until the next day. I don't know whether I pass, you'd call it pass out, or just that I ran completely out of gas. Alcohol seemed to do that to me. Then I couldn't drink the next day. Now I'd have to wait all day long till sometime late in the afternoon when I could get some wine and cheese or something down to stop it, you know. And then that night I could drink again. But about three of those nights would be about it. I'd have to stop, get well, so I could get sick again. So I could get well, so I could get sick again. And I could quit drinking any time I wanted for many years. Sometimes I'd quit for 2 years, 2 months, 2 weeks. But it got so along towards last, I was quitting 3 and 4 times a week. That just goes to prove to you anybody can quit drinking. When I came to AA, they told me I could stay stopped. And that was what amazed me. I heard a young man complaining the other day that he just couldn't seem to make the program. And he was talking about all that was coming up in his future, coming up in his future. And I said, well, you don't have to do it today. And he looked real astounded. I don't think he'd thought about it that way. That was That's what saved my ass, kids. They told me I only had to stay sober one day. And the next thing you knew, I had lots of days. And the longer I stayed around, the happier I got. I'll never forget my first meeting. I walked in the door of a room about like this over at Prune Ridge, and there was a man standing at one side of the door that enveloped my hand in a huge paw. He was about 6'6". And he said, "God love you, I'm glad you're here." And I thought, "What do you got on your mind, you old goat?" In those days, I was young and slender. And on the other side of the door was a gorgeous lady with one of those Marcel hairstyles. And she put her arms around me and kissed me. Now, you gals know what I mean. You want to be kissed by a woman? And I wondered what was her bag. Then we sat down at the meeting, and I'm looking all around at all these odd people. And, God, they were all dressed up. This is before we got so casual. The men had on ties and shirts and suits, and the ladies were all dressed up with their hair beautifully done up. And I thought, don't look like any of these ever had a drink. And then they started talking about a ship out off the rocks out of San Francisco with a belly full of Petri wine. And it was wallowing around out there. It had lost its rudder, and everybody was worried about what was going to happen to the wine. And I was home. Because I was a Scotch wino. I drank Scotch when I could get it, and if I couldn't get it, I'd drink wine. And sometimes I would have some of both. But I loved both of them. I didn't like bourbon very much because it seemed like every time I drank bourbon, I hated the taste of it. And every time I drank the damn stuff, I got in a fight with somebody. And if nobody would pick a fight with me, I'd go hunt somebody to pick a fight with. So I stuck to Scotch and wine most of the time. I finally found vodka. At the NCO clubs, they didn't serve much Scotch, but they didn't serve wine at all, so I had vodka in 7. I think that's when I first started getting fat. That's awful sticky stuff. You know something? We got up one morning and counted our bar tabs, and we'd had 23 of those drinks. Now, you try to drink 23 7-Ups today. Any one of you. You get outside of 3 and you think you're going to spew. I was not a puker. I had a skin just like a balloon. I could hold it all. And my poor sister tried to keep up with me. She threw up all over Coronado Island, the ferries and the cars and the city of San Diego, and never made it to an alcoholic. She just absolutely flunked the course. She couldn't make it. And I was proud of the fact. I would be sitting there at 7 o'clock on a Sunday morning wondering, when's this bunch around me going to show some life? I want to go to T-Town and finish this party. You couldn't get booze in San Diego at that time of day, so we'd go to T-Town. And I was proud of the fact that I drank them all under the table. And I was proud of the fact that I didn't upchuck on anybody. And I'm the one that became the drunk. That's one thing you can always tell them when you're 12-stepping them. They tell you how much they can hold. Tell them, well, you're one. Anybody with a hollow leg is going to make it. Well, I stayed the course till 45, and that was it. I couldn't handle it anymore. I had the good fortune to be standing in the middle of my living room in Spokane, Washington, and I said, "Jesus H. Christ, when are you going to do something about this mess?" There was ashtrays floating in my beautiful koa wood bowls, and there was beer cans rolling around on the floor. The husband had took off and split, and I found out next morning that they stopped him just before he went headfirst into a plate glass window. He didn't know he was walking half bent over. And you know, every time that cheese face did that, he took my wallet and my cigarettes when he left the house. I'll never know how this happened. I called the police station, I guess, to see if he was there one night. And I got a cop on the phone, and we sounded nice to each other. But anyway, I was cussing about him taking the wallet and the cigarettes, and he asked me where I lived, and I told him he brought me a pack. Now, wasn't that nice? I didn't even let him in. So after screaming that, and you know, it didn't seem to me I ever prayed. I didn't realize that's what I did then. But the funniest thing happened. We'd been angling for 10 years in the Air Force to get sent somewhere in the Bay Area, and no way. They told us they'd send us in the Southern Hemisphere from Honolulu, and they sent us to Spokane, Washington. That was the Deep South, I guess, to the guy that made out those orders. Anyway, we got down in the Bay Area. My sister tells me she kept seeing me going through the want ads. I didn't even know I was looking for a job. But then I didn't know what was going on most of the time then. We used to take her baby and put it in a baby buggy and go down to the liquor store and load it up with gallons of wine. And it took two of us and a man walking by to lift that damn thing up the curbs to drive it home. There sat the baby with wine all around under her pillows. I didn't know anybody in my family knew about AA, but one night the four of us get in a hell of a fight. Her husband was an ass. And mine was like me, a little drunk. And we were drinking in the kitchen, and her husband made some crack about her as a bed partner, and she told him she'd never had any complaints before she met him. My jealous little Italian husband turned around and climbed all over me. Just gave me old Billy hell. I hadn't said anything to him about my past. Wasn't any of his business. But that started the fight. So four of us went four different directions. Two out the front door, two out the back door, and Daddy sitting out on the front porch said, "I wish that bunch would all find AA." My sister heard him say it. Well, after reading the want ads, I made a phone call one day, and the next thing you know, I'm managing the first multiple apartment house in Santa Clara. And when the lady was checking out the books to me, she pulled out this folder on apartment 10, and she said, "Now stay away from this big bastard. He's no good. He's one of those alcoholics in AA." You know something? He came down and introduced himself, he and his Al-Anon wife. And don't misunderstand me, she was an Al-Anon. She went to meetings. She wasn't one of those that goes with her husband to sit and watch the monkeys perform. I got no use for those who won't go to Al-Anon and help us a little bit. Anyway, they came to meet me, and I found them absolutely charming. They were the only couple in the whole blasted place that I liked. And he was clever. He never said a word about it. He just stopped every day after work and had a cold drink with me. He told me to get him some Hawaiian punch. That's what he was on now. So I'd have a wine cooler, and he'd have a Hawaiian punch, and he'd sit there until his wife came home from work and collected him and went to their apartment. Every morning, while he's waiting for her to get dressed, he'd stop by to say good morning. Well, he snagged me. 6 weeks later, he got the phone call. And I went to AA. And I didn't stay. We got transferred to Texas. And I'll show you how stupid we alcoholics are. All those old-timers who knew exactly what could happen to me told me what to do. Don't worry about finding an apartment or a church or anything else. Go to an AA meeting the minute you get there. Well, after we got our apartment all settled and got all settled in, then I looked up Alcoholics Anonymous, and then I went to a few meetings, and them stupid Texans did not know how to hold Santa Clara Valley AA. Their meetings were not any good. And I went to meetings for a while, about 9 months. And then about 9 months, I didn't go at all. And my drinking partner didn't like for me to quit. because he wasn't ready to. And, you know, some of you have heard me tell you this before. At the time I joined AA, I decided I'd divorce that sucker right on the spot because he was to blame for my problems. Let's face it, I wouldn't have been doing the things I was doing if it wasn't for him. And my sponsor said, no, you don't. You stick right with him. It's not his drinking problem you're here for. It's your own. And besides, you haven't got brains enough to make a decision. You just got on the program. And until you've been, if you want me for a sponsor, you won't make a major decision this first year. And by God, I didn't. When I came back after a year and a half, I said, I'm going to divorce him now. She said, well, good. I'm glad to hear it. And I said, well, how come you wouldn't let me before? She said, I told you. You didn't have brains enough to make such a big decision. You would have quit him for AA. And because you still cared about him, you'd have quit AA because it broke up your marriage. Wasn't she clever? And then one day I got nasty with her. Cutest little old lady you ever saw. I picked one much older than myself and who'd been on the program a long time. Because anybody my own age, I'd have told them where to get off at. But she was talking one day at a meeting and I was mad at her. We have a great facility for getting mad at our sponsors. For resenting our sponsors because they refuse to corroborate our opinions. They keep telling us we're wrong. And they keep telling us, we don't know how to do this thing about staying sober. So I said, and I'd never said an unkind word to an older person before, and I turned around and said, you old bitch, I don't think you've ever drunk in your life. All you ever do is get up at meetings and talk about the goddamn steps. She says, Dorothy, I am sorry, and I apologize abjectly. I have been on the program so long that all I talk about is the steps. And you're my baby, and I should have shared what used to be like with you. Otherwise, how could you identify with me? So then she told me about crawling around the kitchen floor in her own puke and the cat manure, searching through the garbage can and throwing the garbage all over the floor, hunting for a bottle. And told me about each of her three husbands being salesmen who were gone from home long periods of time, and that's how she conducted herself while they were gone. When she knew they were coming home, she sobered up, and they never saw a bit of this. They didn't have any idea what a drunk she was. Well, you know, that made me feel like a piker. I hadn't been that far down in the bottle yet. I was lucky. I didn't have to go that far. Somebody told me in time how I could get out of my misery. Needless to say, my sponsor's been dead many years, and you know I still hear her. Once in a while, I'll be thinking about something, and I'll be saying, but damn it, I'm justified in this. I'm right in this. And I can hear Zella twinkling that little bracelet on her arms. Oh, how I hated that bracelet and her knitting. This woman kept telling me that every time I had a brilliant idea, it wasn't any good. And every time I bragged to her about the wonderful person I'd always been, she pointed out to me what a stinker I had always been. And then she'd tell me she loved me. And I thought, well, if she has such a rotten opinion of me, how could she love me? But you know, to this day, if I've got a terrible decision to make, I hear Zella. I hear her telling me to hold still and do nothing, and to pray until I get an answer, that I only have to stay sober one day at a time, and I can't live tomorrow, so forget tomorrow. If it don't take care of itself, I will gain, you know where it says, and the wisdom to know the difference? She says, that's when it comes to me, when I get the wisdom to know the difference between whether it's right or wrong for me to take a certain action. I remember being on the program about 3 or 4 years, and I said to some old-timer who had just got up and announced that he was so damn full of serenity that he was sickening. And I met him after the meeting and wanted to know where the hell he got it, because I didn't have any of it. You know, when I hear people say that they feel serene and contented and happy, and they've only been in the program 3 or 4 years, I look at them in absolute amazement. Well, I was on the program a year before I understood the steps. I did not understand them. And then when 13 of us got together in my apartment, and it had one window, and there was 25 of us in there smoking and drinking coffee, you could have cut it with a knife. But we finally, after 2 or 3 meetings, weeded it out where there was only 13 still left, and we decided those 13 would be the board. So we put a hat in the middle of the floor and handed everybody blank envelopes so that anybody who wanted to could put in any amount of money they wanted to, and whatever we got was going to get us a place to have a downtown fellowship. All we had was the country club out on Fair Avenue. No buses ran out there. Hitchhiking was pretty poor out in that country area. And the poor devils, a poor gal got out of jail downtown. Where the hell was she going? So we started the Downtown Fellowship, 13 of us, 12 drunks and one Al-Anon. We were clever. We knew what they'd say about us, so we got an Al-Anon as a treasurer. They couldn't say we were stealing their money. We knew what that crowd would say out at the old club. So, and we all kept our identity secret until we got our papers from the AA lawyer in San Francisco, which we could publish with our intents and how we were going to run it according to the traditions. But until that time, some of the old-timers, in fact, the oldest woman member in the valley, kept getting phone calls from other old-timers telling her what that bunch of crooks was going to do when they opened that place downtown. And she was one of the ringtail leaders. Well, needless to say, when we published it in the Good News, which didn't used to be a little secret letter, it used to be a big paper with a lot in it, we published the whole thing in there, and then all the names came out. That flourished for 13 years. What am I saying? Flourished? It was broke all the time. We were begging all the time. We used to go out to these outside meetings, the silk sheeters meetings, and put flyers on all the seats. Try to get a little AA in there, hope they'd leave a little of their money when they left. Well, you know, I complained my head off about how busy I was. There were times when I had Ruthie in this telephone and old Cowboy Cliff on this phone. They had just had a beautiful fight over one of the traditions, and they both called me. And there I have them both at one time, and I screamed my head off about how they were all driving me nuts. I had the misfortune of having a hotel within just a few blocks of this downtown fellowship, and my phone became the central, the nerve center. It was years before I looked back and realized they sure kept me sober, kids. They kept me sober. We always had a problem, though. Our managers kept getting drunk. You know why? Damned old alcoholic ego. Nobody does anything around here but me. I have to scrub the floors. I have to wash the cups. I have to do everything. So we, by this time, we get a few halfway houses done. So we go to the halfway houses, and we get a bunch of fellas volunteering. They come down there, and they'd last a week or two, and they'd never come back. You know why? The cotton-picking manager run them off because he didn't have anything to bitch about if he had all that help. And he'd stay there day and night, and he'd get drunk, just like our 9-month sobrieties who become counselors. Listen, I was sober for 10 years when the state called me to become a counselor, and for 3 days I was sick as a goat. And I said to Frank, "What the hell's the matter with me?" He said, "You're not built to wear two hats. And if you go down there as a counselor, you won't have anything left for the phone calls you get at home." And he said, "It's got you scared to death." Now, he said, "Make a decision. Which are you going to do?" And I decided 12-stepping was better for me. And that's why I didn't ever become a counselor. Thank God, because I am an awful, tough, mean sponsor. And I just can't imagine what I'd have done with some of those jerks that had been in and out of 5 or 6 halfway houses and then come squalling to me about they can't make it. I'd tell them about those who made it, like little Joe out at the West Side Club, who slept in Mercury Hotel one night, Buick Hotel another. There was a wrecking yard out back of my hotel, and that's where he slept nights. And the other little guy on the welfare that was crippled and spoke, I don't know what language he spoke, because you couldn't understand him either in Portuguese or English. But they made it the hard way. They suffered so damn bad getting sober that they found out that getting drunk to get sober again was just too damn rough. And Frankie made 9 years before he died. And he had every reason in the world, because he suffered excruciating pain before he died. And he didn't even want to take aspirin. He was afraid it wouldn't be good for him. And he had a nasty temper. He was all of 5'1" and the terror of the county jail. They were all scared to death of him. And after our sponsors were gone, he decided I was his sponsor. He'd always call me his big sister. And only way I could control him was to say, Frankie, you can't do it that way. It's not the AA way. And if you told him it wasn't the AA way, he wouldn't do it that way. In school, because of brain damage that he'd had as a child, they could not teach him to read and write. After he was in the program 3 or 4 years, he was reading a pamphlet to me, and I said, how the hell did you read that? Have you memorized it? He said, no. I got to learn to read if I'm going to be part of the program. Makes me want to cry when I think that he could make it. He had a broken hip, ulcers, one kidney, tubercular spots on his lungs, no teeth, no glasses. And he and his crutch used to get drunk and fall all over downtown San Jose. He was doing a lifetime sentence at the county farm. He'd get out and he'd be back in 24 hours. And he came to the downtown fellowship just after we opened its doors. And he came in and he went to work. And he scrubbed floors and he served drinks and he threatened 6-footers with mayhem if they didn't behave. He made it. Now do you see why I get mad when some people pretty close to me keep goofing it up? Phony bastard getting halfway houses to get out of the rain, not to get sober. They used to go to Agnew to get out of... you know what one of the guys out at Agnew told me? He said, we hate alcoholics out there. They use it for a winter resort. That's one of the reasons they were mistreated out there. They made them clean bedpans and things like that. But we didn't have any halfway houses then. When a girl got out of jail, she had to find a wino that had the money enough to have some place to sack out so she would have a place to get under a roof. So we finally got together, a bunch of old soaks, and again, in the face of a lot of BS from old-timers, we got a women's recovery house on 4th Street. Well, then it hit the fan. We got an old gal in there that was a hard-nosed, sober AA. And those young gals tried to pull the wool over her eyes and didn't succeed. They didn't realize she'd been in more jails and more beds than any of them ever had. She said, I've had more no-name lovers than you could count. And let her find one pill. And you could call it an aspirin, and she'd say, it's a pill. And you were out. That was all there was to it. Out. And I was called everything but a lady, because every time I found out that one of the alcoholics in my hotel took a drink, they were out. Let's face it, the only way you got a room in my hotel was for some sponsor who had a job, who had answered a 12-step call, came and rented you a room so that you could have a chance to sober up and so that you could go to the downtown fellowship and get the message. And you think I was going to let anybody lay his butt in my hotel and drink on the money some hardworking man had paid? Out. One of them said to me, "You're a hell of an AA." I said, "The best." Then I had a gal there. She used to be a strip teaser in San Diego. And she came in with a black eye and a bloody nose. Her husband had moved it over an inch or two. And she was all bunged up and limping. And when she was signing in, I told she and her sponsor that if she took a drink, she would choose to leave my hotel. And if she didn't, I would call her a black taxi and she could leave. Well, she went back to her room and thought about that. Her words were, "Who's that old blonde bitch think she is to talk to me that way?" So she packed her suitcase and went somewhere else. And I never knew she'd moved out because she was there again that night. And she became one of the best kids we ever had on the program. And she told it at a meeting, and I didn't ever know she had moved out and back in again. But we had to do it, because if you get one drunk, you'll break out in the damnedest batch of them you ever saw. And just let one lady get drunk, and you get five guys drunk with her, all in the same bed. You know, Frank and I have been in Washington, Oregon, Nevada, Arizona, Texas, and Alabama, and we have had people say to us, "Do you remember the old downtown fellowship in San Jose?" And you think that don't make us feel good to realize that San Jose had something that was that great. And you know what? We had to fight the old-timers, AA, and its bucks every step of the way. You see, when we get sober, we get tight zippers on our wallets. You know, we start paying our bills instead of running away from them or running out and hiding from them. And we have a hell of a time starting a facility that will take care of those who can't take care of themselves. And then we fought the county to get them to help us. We fought the county to get a little hospitalization without that box of phenobarb about this big enough to get the army drunk. Every time they came back to my hotel, the doctor would call me and tell me, "Now, go to his room and take that stuff away from him. Give him his regular dosages for 3 days. If he don't go in the DTs, the bastard is on the road. Put it down the toilet. It'll be good for both of them." And that's what we had to do with all those drugs that were sent home with them. Then we got a drying out hospital in the Santa Cruz Mountains. Two alcoholics started it. Then we got a few halfway houses. And then somebody came up with a big batch of Santa Clara County money. And they opened over 100 halfway houses. And let me tell you, every sucker in town was running to get on the bandwagon, make a big batch of money off those alcoholics, and give a damn if you stayed sober or not. They just wanted to be sure they got paid every month. And if you got drunk before 90 days, they had to take you back, because then that cut off the funds and they had to go through all that paperwork. And I went to the comptroller of the state and tried to do something about it, and he said, "I wish to God I could." But he said, "Dorothy, it's not state money." But he says, "They're getting ready to run out." He says, "You watch the halfway houses close up." And they did. And that revolving door got shut. You know, my old sponsor used to tell me, if it's good, it'll last. And if it's not, it'll go. If it's good for AA, it'll last. Well, all those halfway houses didn't last. There's not many of them left. And those that are not, if you'll ever go to the council meetings, and you notice those that are not strongly affiliated with AA don't get funds anymore. Thank God. I was down to the ranch the other day, and I gave a talk about these people that go in and out of the halfway houses, and I said, you know, when you've spent months out here living on the taxpayer's money and his bounty and his because he cares about you, and then you get out and go right back to what you were doing before, you're a crook, a phony, and a thief. You phonied it up so that you could live for free, and you got out and cheated yourself, stole from yourself your opportunity that was given you. And they keep saying the door swings both ways, you can come back. The hell you can. Not if you're dead. Not if you're like the fellow that was in the vacant lot next to my hotel. They went in there with a bulldozer to chop up the weeds, and he was in them. You see, you don't know you can come back. You might get in a car and kill several people, including yourself. It's one of the most dangerous weapons is the world, is a damn drunk behind a steering wheel. And if you're given an opportunity to get sober and you don't take it, I'm not going to make many friends with this statement, but I think after three or four times, they ought to tell you, hit the road. Go shake it out. You damned right. How many of you in here shook it out without any help at all? Let's see some hands. Quite a few. Sheila, put your hand up. Nobody helped you. Really? One gal told me I was the meanest bitch she ever knew in her life. She said I was laying there on my couch expecting to die, and you come over there and cuss me out and then turn around and tell me I'm not an alcoholic, I'm just a common drunk. She come up off that couch. She's still sober up in Sacramento somewhere. You remember old Dusty. But you know, you stop to think. You've tried to kill yourself on booze for years. And some of us has made it a lot worse. Now, I can't say I was an addict and an alcoholic. I don't know what you'd call it. I was like Dr. Bob. I took pills to keep going every day. You can't lean over a jewelry counter showing diamonds when you can't see them. And your eyeballs are swimming around in that red-hot fluid. And your breath tastes like the bottom of a birdcage. So you have to take some kind of pill. And I was lucky. I was in the Air Force. Hell, if they can't see it or cut on it, they'll give you a pill for it. So they had me boxes of pills. I could take my choice of which color I wanted. Then I went to work. And I made it until my last break in the afternoon. Then I'd go over to the photography studio where my drinking buddy was, and she and I'd have a beer or two. And then I'd chew gum to beat hell that last quarter of the day. And then we'd go to the NCO club and get drunk. And my husband was much younger than me, and that sucker would go to work the next morning, sign in at the hangar, go back, go to bed, and there I was behind the jewelry counter taking my pills and selling jewelry. And I used to hate him. God, how I resented that. I wanted to go back and get in bed and get well, too, so I could get drunk that same night. There are people in AA that don't like to hear you say that you had a lot of fun with your stuff and your booze. But I did. God, I had a great time. I was in charge of several pieces of property in San Diego, which made me a fine income. And I was able to hire help to take care of all these pieces of property and my children. And I was still young enough that I could drink all I wanted to. And it was just party. It was just fun. I didn't drink every day, and I didn't drink every night. But when I did, boy, I sure tried to beat everybody else to the bottom of the bottle. I know what the, you know, they didn't surprise me when they said that first drink gets you drunk. Because it had always been that way with me. Hell, I could go on a milkshake binge for 6 months. But just let me have a drink. And that was it. The hell with the milkshake. Bring on the booze. And I love the taste. I loved the effect. I loved the fun. I loved all the hell I got into, and I got into lots of it. My sister and I were divorcees. You can just imagine, we were in San Diego during the war, and there was only 12 or 15 men to every woman. And we were the gals who had the places to rent, and so everybody was awful nice to us. I mean, if you didn't like what we did, you could get the hell out. So our tenants, we had 250 tenants, and I'll tell you what, we couldn't get drunk anywhere in town without somebody pick us up and take us home, take care of us. So we were well protected. I remember one time there was a great big good-looking sailor kept trying to get a dance with me, and every time he did, somebody at my table popped up and took me on the dance floor. Finally, he come over and he said, "Lady, I'd like to dance with you, but you're better protected than a goddamn nun in a convent." But you see, then came the change. My fun thing turned out to be poison. And my system was becoming more and more poisoned with it. And it got so I didn't wake up and laugh and giggle and say, "I bet I had a hell of a good time last night." I woke up knowing I had a hell of a bad time last night. And I woke up knowing that I was going to hurt all day and maybe into the next day, sometimes 3 days. And I would just dread the next party we were going to go to. And that's why I said in Spokane, "Jesus Christ, when are you going to do something about this awful mess?" And he did it. I got moved to the Bay Area. I got into Santa Clara. And I found AA here. And I'll tell you something. I'm prejudiced. It's not near as good anywhere else. It's good, but it isn't as good. I'll tell you another thing, too. You go anywhere else, and you're apt to be a little disappointed until you teach them how. I went to one of the oldest meetings in Dallas, and them suckers sat on their hands, and they didn't say hi to you when you got up to speak. And I was with several people from California, and we'd say hi, and they all looked around at us. And when somebody finished talking, we applauded him, and they gave us another look. We kept doing it every year when we went back to Dallas. See, I travel on the road for a living. And when we'd go to the shows in Dallas, we'd go to the meetings there, and we'd do that. And you know what? Now when Frank and I go to Texas, they are applauding, and they are saying hi when you introduce yourself. They liked that came from California. I went to AA in New York, and when I come out of there, I wasn't sure, but I thought I was Irish Catholic. In fact, I heard one little guy get up and say that he was in this Murphy's boarding house, another name for a drying out place, and he said he went to Mass the third Sunday before he realized he was a Jew. But I finally learned to take it there, too. One night I was in this little church out in Jamaica, and there was a little blonde lady with a cute little brown velvet hat on, and she and I were the only one. Everybody got up and went, "Shh." As soon as the meeting was over, everybody went, "Shh." She and I was in the kitchen washing cups, and she told me somewhat of her story. And I listened, and we finished the cups, and I said I hoped I'd see her again. She said the same to me, and I never did see her again. About 5 years later, they were having a conference in Bakersfield. And I said to the gentleman I was dating there, "I'm going to Bakersfield." And he's on the railroad and working, and he couldn't get off. So I went anyway. Because I said, "Marty Mann, The first woman in Alcoholics Anonymous is going to speak, and I'm going to be there and hear her, because I already had heard that she's getting ready to retire. So I went, and I'm sitting in the back of this room, shoving down gobs of steak, and this lady is speaking, and something hit me. I'd heard that story before. Now I looked up, and there's that same little blonde lady saying that same story without the little brown hat. Here I had had Marty Mann's story in the kitchen washing cups, and I had waited 5 more years to go and hear her talk. Well, you know, us alcoholics aren't always too swift. Sometimes we come half unwrapped and think we're normal. I'll never forget the guy that was sober 16 years, and he told me, he said, without the bottle, I'm just as normal as anybody else. Well, if he is, those normies do some awful odd things. Well, I've talked overtime, and I've enjoyed every minute of it because I haven't been to many meetings recently, and I was full of gab. I will tell you, though, I'm going on 22 years of straight, stringent sobriety. God didn't give it to me. He gave me the opportunity to get it from you folks and from the books and from the meetings from New England to Honolulu, from Canada to Mexico. You don't ever have to go anywhere and be alone. You don't ever have to go to another place and be lonely. But if you walk in and expect to be discovered like a starlet, you're full of shit. They won't do it. You go in and stick your hand out and say, I'm Dorothy. And everywhere we've ever gone, you'd think that when we left that they were going to die without us. That's AA. That's what has kept me sober. I never could have done it without you. And I love every one of you, and God bless you.